For those of you who've spent the summer trying to nurture a vegetable garden, here's a story to make you jealous. Commentator Julie Zicofus has done her share of planting and weeding, but she is finding delight these days in plants that appear and thrive by accident.
Every time I plod out to my garden, jaw set, to pull up the nasty old green bean plants that have collapsed on the straw, their yellowed leaves riddled by bean beetles, they surprise me. They've set the table with new white blossoms, and they've made dinner for me again. And so I stay their execution and decide not to replant. Why start over with a puppy when the old dog still has spring in her step? I pick the prickly yellow beetle larvae off the leaves and toss them over the fence. I keep the plants picked clean, weeded, and mulched. They look terrible, but they keep us in beans, and that's all that matters. It's practically free gardening, if you don't count the hours spent weeding and the bales of straw bought to keep the bindweed down. You plant the seed and nurture it for a while, and then stand back and let the burgeoning vegetation do the rest. Come late summer, you take a big plastic tote out each time you visit. There's that much food flooding back into your kitchen. For the first time ever, I've kept the tomatoes tied up in their cages, and I can move among them without the pop and spurt of fruit under my bare feet. I listen to the swelling sizzle of cicadas dodging their bomber flights through the garden, hear the steady hum of crickets and katydids in the meadow, the sputtering zizz of bumblebees working the blazing zinnias. I kneel to extract a huge tomato, the size, shape, and purplish color of a human kidney, from a jumble of fragrant stalks in its cage, working it up through the thick leaves. I heft it in my hand, marveling, then pluck a basil leaf and take a bite out of its smooth purple side. I grew this tomato from a seed, saved on a paper towel from last summer's crop. I sit down in the prickly straw to consider this odd and delicious fruit. It's the size and shape of the pink Anderson beefsteak from which I gathered its seed, but it's the oddest color of purple, and the flavor is zingier. A smile spreads across my face as I realize that its other parent must be the little black crim tomatoes I grew last summer. I'd found one in a party-colored basket of heirloom cherries and saved the seed. In my palm, I'm holding a tomato that's uniquely my own, a deep maroon delight, heavy of flesh and sparse of seed, with a more complex, nuttier flavor than its pinkish parent. And it's heavy with fruit, bundles and bundles of it. Why, I could propagate it, name it anything I want, give it to special friends to grow. This is how it happens, I think. This is how brand new plant varieties come to be, in the happy accidents and the hum and bumble of bees. In a small Ohio garden, a long way from anywhere.
Commentator Julie Zicofus lives on a nature sanctuary near Whipple, Ohio. She's the author of Letters from Eden, A Year at Home in the Woods. It's All Things Considered from NPR News.
Next Sunday marks 5 years since Hurricane Katrina made landfall as a Category 5 hurricane. At least 1,800 people died from the effects of the storm, and the lives of so many more were drastically changed. CNN special correspondent Soledad O'Brien covered Katrina. She's covered the aftermath, and she was just back to report on one community with a long historic tie to New Orleans. Pontchartrain Park, a middle-class black community, was one of the hardest hit by Katrina, and Soledad O'Brien documented its journey in a documentary titled New Orleans Rising, and Soledad joins us now from CNN New York. Soledad, thanks so much for joining us once again.
It's always my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So why did you decide to focus on this particular community?
We looked at a lot of communities, and the question we were trying to answer was, so how's New Orleans now? Because that's what I'm asked all the time, pretty much wherever I go. And what I liked about the focus on Pontchartrain Park was its history. Pontchartrain Park was the first place that African Americans could buy a home in the 1950s. So it has this amazing history. And it also has this amazing hero, Wendell Pierce, the actor, you know him from The Wire and Tremé, who became this kind of accidental developer when he stepped forward to help people who wanted to return, like his parents and like other elderly people in the community. He stepped forward to kind of coalesce all this energy around, can we do it? Because even though, as you point out, and we point out in the documentary, still only a third of the people had returned. So it's a real struggle for a community that should be one of the best situated to return financially and otherwise.
Well, I want to hear a little bit more about why it's been so difficult. But first, I want to just play a short clip from the documentary from one of the interviews you did with Wendell Pierce. I must say, a lot of people know that he's a New Orleans native, but I don't think I knew until I saw your film just what an active role he has been playing in the reconstruction of that area. Let's just play a short clip. Here it is.
Pontchartrain Park. It is a labor of love. It is my community, it's my home, and I would do every and anything to make sure it's restored. I need to rebuild, because we are a family. Nothing counts so much as family.
But as you point out in the documentary, not everybody is as excited about rebuilding and moving back as Wendell Pierce is. Here is an interview you did with the wife of one of Wendell's childhood friends, Lisa Oubre.
If I were to go and look at Wendell's wonderful new home, it's almost like a home that's now been built over, you know, a battlefield. That's what it feels like. You know that something so bad has happened here, and you have this wonderful home that's now built over all of this sadness and so much pain and loss. I can't reconcile the two.
Is that a common feeling?
I know so many people like Lisa Oubre. It's terrible. Maybe they're not fighting with their spouse about moving back. Maybe it's a mother-daughter, maybe it's siblings who say, you know, one person says, I just can't do it. I just cannot bring myself. Lisa Oubre has moved on. She moved to Baton Rouge, moved in with family members in kind of a makeshift situation, lots of people living in one house, but she's a manager at the Home Depot. You know, she's moved her life on, and she says, you know, the way I can heal is to get my life on track in a new direction. The way that her husband, Herbie Oubre, moves on is to try to figure out how to rebuild in Pontchartrain Park. And those are obviously two trains going two opposite directions. And it's so sad because when you sit down and talk to them, they clearly like each other and love each other, but this issue is ripping them apart. And I cannot tell you the number of people I know who will say, you know, my parents called and say, should I move back? And I have to say, I don't know. I don't know. You should, maybe you shouldn't. That, to me, was sort of a very consistent theme in whatever neighborhood you were from in New Orleans.
But to that point, though, there has been a discrepancy between the pace at which other communities have rebuilt and this historically Black community. And as you point out, this is a community that is 93% homeowners. Why is it that this community, which was almost as hard hit as Ward 9, but hasn't seen as much support and doesn't seem to be able to rally as quickly. Were you able to figure that out?
That was our question, you know, and my question was, so is this race or is this something else? And it turns out the answer is more something else. Pontchartrain Park is a community of elderly people, and that at its core was the problem. People who were in their 80s, some of them just couldn't really take moving back. So what Wendell's trying to do is to say, great, let's renovate these homes and move younger people into Pontchartrain Park. It should not fall to the hands of developers. But as Wendell Pierce likes to say, not everyone has your best interests at heart. And I'd say, well, what does that mean? Are you saying it's racism? Are you saying it's discrimination? Are you saying what? And I think that he felt as he went through this process that they were the people who had their own best interests at heart. So the community was going to buy up the homes and create a system in which they could bring people back, keep the profit, plow it back into the community, make a senior citizen's home, and save themselves.
Final question. It's a tough one. This was 5 years after Katrina. If you and I come back 5 years from now, what do you think we'll see?
Much better. I think it's a 10-year rebuilding program. So many people have said that to me. I think you've seen tons of progress, 80-some-odd percent, maybe 83% of the city's back. And some pockets are really slow. But for me, what is an indication of the good news is that people are fighting to do it. I mean, they've sort of given up on it's going to happen quickly and someone's going to come in, that someone from somewhere is going to come in and save us. I think just as in the immediate aftermath of the storm, there's no someone coming to save you. So get yourself together and save yourselves. And that's what Wendell, more than anything, is marketing. He says, you know, what the Pontchartrain Park Community Development Corporation, ourselves, are saving ourselves. And this can be a model for anyone who's in New Orleans or outside of New Orleans. Save yourselves. This is how to do it. That's really the message he wants to give.
Soledad O'Brien is CNN special correspondent. Her latest documentary, New Orleans Rising, premieres tomorrow on CNN. And Soledad, we're also looking forward to your forthcoming memoir, which will be out later this fall. So
memoir sounds old, doesn't it? Don't you have to be like 90 to write a memoir? I consider it just a book.
Your latest book. We'll look forward to that. Soledad joined us from New York. Thanks, Soledad.
My pleasure.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. This week, researchers looking at new images of the moon say there's evidence that the moon shrank, but only by a little bit, about a billion years ago. The images were taken by Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. It's been working hard for over a year now, snapping pictures of our nearest neighbor. And part of the orbiter's mission is to find landing sites for the next moon mission, if there is one, or to find places that would be potential pit stops if we go to Mars. But aside from helping scientists look for a landing pad, pictures from the orbiter are filling in some gaps in our understanding of the moon's geology, an area we know surprisingly little about, researchers say. Joining me now to talk more about it is my guest, Thomas R. Waters, is a senior scientist at the Center for Earth and Planetary Studies. That's at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington, and his research was published in the journal Science. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm a real fan of the show.
Well, thank you very much. That's very kind of you. How do you know the moon is shrinking?
Yeah, we know because we have used the very high-resolution images obtained by the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter cameras to look for a specific kind of landform called a lobate scarp. And these are basically sort of stair steps in the landscape. If you were on the ground looking at one of these things, it would look like it would just rise up and then sort of flatten out in the back scarp of the area of the landform. So these things are actually caused by thrust faults, and thrust faults are structures that are formed when the crust actually is pushed together and breaks, and then part of the crust is actually pushed up or thrust and creates this scarp face or cliff.
So it's like you see a ridge line of cliffs.
That's right. You see these very sort of linear cliff-like structures that are indicating that the crust has actually shrank.
Huh. And how much shrinking did it do, and is it still shrinking?
That's an excellent question. What we've looked at is the number of these scarps, and I just wanted to let you know that we first knew about these scarps from Apollo-era photography. Camera that was flown on the Apollo panoramic, I'm sorry, on the Apollo missions, the 15, 16, and 17 Apollo missions, it's called the panoramic camera, and it was this really fantastic camera that could take very high resolution pictures of the surface. And we first detected these landforms, these lobate scarps, in those images, again, 40 years ago or so. But those images were confined to a very small area of the moon and in the equatorial zone. And what's been fantastic about the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter camera is it's allowed us now to see well beyond those areas. And, and some of these scarps that we've found are actually sitting at very high latitudes. In fact, some of them are sitting very near the lunar poles. The reason we need these high-resolution images is because these fault scarps are not very big. They're typically only several kilometers long and maybe tens of meters high. So if you add up all the contraction that's occurred from the ones that we know about, it adds up to about 100 meters or so change in or reduction of the radius of the moon. So it's not a whole lot.
Wow, I'm surprised it's even detectable at such a small level like that. And what does it tell us about the moon that we didn't know before?
Well, it tells us that something global has happened. I mean, because, again, we didn't know that these thrust fault scarps occurred everywhere on the moon until we had the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter camera images. Now that we know that, we know it must be related to a global process. And the most plausible global process is interior cooling. So as the interior of the moon cooled, it contracted, and that contraction ends up causing the crust of the moon to have to adjust to that decrease in volume and creates the thrust fault scarps that we're looking at.
So is this something new, that the interior of the moon was hot enough and could cool? Or what is different about the makeup of the moon that this implies?
I think what's new is the fact that, again, we now know that we speculated and we're pretty sure that the moon was cooling. Like every other object in the solar system, they pretty much started off hot and then cool over time. But what's really interesting about these thrust fault scarps is the fact that, one, that they're young. We know from looking at cross-cutting relationships between the fault scarp and these very small diameter craters that the scarps can't be any more than about a billion years old. But the fact is that they look much more recent than that. They're very pristine, very undegraded. They look literally like they could have formed yesterday.
Huh. And it's believed that the moon was formed when a Mars-sized planetoid banged into the Earth and ripped it off the Earth, correct?
That's right. That's the most popular theory right now for the origin of the moon.
Does this discovery do anything to change that idea?
No, I don't think so. I think what it does is it tells us that the initial starting temperature of the moon was not hot enough to have melted the entire planet. It was probably hot, but not hot enough, and just hot enough maybe to have melted the outer portion of the crust of the moon, but not the entire interior, and not all at once. So it tells us something about the thermal history of the moon. It tells us that the moon has cooled, but it hasn't cooled by as much as some other planets in the solar system. For example, Mercury. Mercury has these same sort of lobate scarp structures, but they're much, much bigger. Instead of being typically several kilometers long, scarps on Mercury will be hundreds of kilometers long, and instead of being just tens of meters high, they can be over a kilometer high. So Mercury, by comparison, has gone through a lot more contraction than the moon has, and that tells us that something very different happened about the way the moon and Mercury evolved.
The Apollo astronauts also left on the surface, if I remember correctly, some moonquake detectors.
That's exactly right.
And there have been some moonquakes that have happened, and now that you look at this, would that now seem logical if the crust is moving or it's contracting, that there would be these little quakes?
Well, that's one of the really, really intriguing questions about this, because these scarps do appear to be very young. The fact that they are so young really suggests that the moon may be still tectonically active. And we know from four seismic stations that were put on the moon that the moon does have moonquakes. The really, again, interesting question is, are any of those moonquakes, and about 30 of them or so were shallow earthquakes, or moonquakes, I should say, and the really interesting question is, are any of those moonquakes related to the development or growth of these very young thrust faults?
You hear about rethinking our ideas about the moon, about how much water there might be. Now you're adding another tectonic question.
Right.
it's not as boring a place as we once led it to be.
Yes, I think it's been a misconception that the moon is this geologically dead object, that everything of significance that happened geologically on the moon happened billions of years ago. But I think that's really just turning out not to be the case. And these very young thrust faults that are globally distributed really are suggesting that the moon may still be tectonically active today.
If you were to treat the moon as a new place to explore, then what kind of probe would you send back to the moon to further this research?
Well, it would be really fantastic to have another set of operating seismic stations on the moon. That would really help us to determine whether some of these faults that we're looking at are actually active or not. And it would help us figure out the internal structure of the moon much better than we know now.
Mm-hmm. And is anything like that planned or anything in the works?
Yes, it's actually being discussed. It's one of those future possibilities that I'm very hopeful will come about.
If I parse your language, it says it's a great idea. We don't have any money for it yet.
Well, money is always an issue, and of course it's a big solar system, and we have many objects that we're trying to explore. But the moon is a fascinating place. I mean, it's our closest celestial body, even though it has been the most intensely studied in some respects. In many respects, we know still very little about it.
It's funny that, from what I understand, that one of these little plateaus was actually a place where some of the Apollo astronauts drove around.
That's
their
exactly
moon,
right.
Their moon rover there.
That's exactly right. One of these ones that we knew about from the Apollo era was very close to the Apollo 17 landing site. And astronauts Cernan and Schmidt actually drove their roving vehicle up the scarp face. And actually, as they tried to drive straight up the scarp, they lost traction and had to actually start zigging and zagging to get up the scarp. So they have the great distinction of being the only two humans to have ever explored an extraterrestrial fault scarp.
Wow. And did they know that's what it was before they went up it?
I think they were pretty sure, and Jack Schmidt, who was a geologist, I think recognized that this was very likely a fault scarp.
And you say it's unusual that you find it so even close to the northern pole of the moon.
Well, that's been one of the really, again, exciting developments. So we've only imaged less than 10% of the moon with these really high-resolution Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter camera images. And so having found scarps that are near the poles and elsewhere on the moon with that very small coverage so far is really exciting, because it means we're probably going to find a lot more of these as the mission continues and we return more and more images.
Might well be. Well, mind if we follow along with you on this, Dr.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Well, we'll have
I'd
you.
Love it.
You're more than welcome to come back and talk about your latest findings.
Well, thank you very much.
Good luck to you. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
You're welcome. Thomas R. Waters is a senior scientist at the Center for Earth and Planetary Studies, and that's at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington. We're going to take a break and come closer to home. We're going to leave the moon and go back to the Gulf of Mexico and talk about how difficult scientists are having doing research there, difficulties they're having there and being kept away from a lot of the places they'd like to go. Our number 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. What's your view on this? Give us a call or send us a tweet. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the blogosphere and get a chance to hear from you, our Tell Me More listeners. Producer Lee Hill, our digital media guy, joins me here in the studio as usual. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Michelle. Well, I think it's fair to say this week's parenting conversation made a lot of jaws drop, and it definitely inspired people to get online and share their feedback. Tuesday, we talked to a group of moms who share a unique experience. They were mistaken for the nannies of their multiracial or simply different-looking children. Here's a clip from that conversation with featured mom Jamila Bay.
I am African American. That's incredibly obvious, especially if you're looking at my hair. My husband is Caucasian. My son, he's got blonde hair and gray blue eyes. I was in an elevator one day. He was in a stroller, and a woman looked at him and said, Oh, so beautiful, so beautiful. Are you looking for more work? And she said, oh, well, you know, you're just so good with him. And when I realized what she was asking, it hurt.
And as you might imagine, in response to that conversation, we received quite a bit of feedback. Here's a note we received from listener Ingrid. She writes, I'm white. My husband is Ethiopian. Our three children are grown now, but when they were young, I was sometimes asked where I had gotten my children and complimented for having helped children in need.
Oh, me.
Oh, wow.
But other listeners, like Michael, had a different message. He writes, good God, people, toughen up. It's a hard world, and getting questioned if you are a nanny for a baby of a different color than you is hardly anything to get worked up over. He goes on to write, I'm white. My wife is black. Our child is also black. I have been questioned and could care less about what people think.
Thank you, Michael. And continuing on the parenting theme, this week we talked about the rising popularity of sperm donation as a means for forming a family. And we spoke with one child who was conceived through sperm donation, and she talked about how she feels that experience has affected her life. Following that conversation, our producer, Alicia Montgomery, penned something for the Tell Me More blog about her decision to choose a sperm donor as a means of conceiving her child. Quite a few people also wrote to us about that. Here's a post from commenter Camila. She writes, I'm 30 years old and have not had much luck finding a loving husband, yet I believe experiencing motherhood is my destiny. If I don't get married in the next 5 years, I intend to have a family without a father. As long as my children will grow up in a household of love with plenty of family and friends to support and mentor them, I know they will turn out fine. I grew up without a father, and I grew into an educated, productive member of society. Thanks, Camila. Lee, what else?
Last week on the program, we discussed the celebrity buzz surrounding the war crimes trial of former Liberian leader Charles Taylor. Now, the case involves his alleged trading of so-called blood diamonds, and it stirred quite a frenzy when supermodel Naomi Campbell testified about diamonds she received. We learned that Jeremy Ratcliffe, head of former South African President Nelson Mandela's Children's Fund, confessed he's been in control of the diamonds since 1997. That's when Campbell gave them to him, she says, because she wanted them to go to charity. Well, yesterday, Ratcliffe resigned from his post and turned the gems over to South African police.
And Lee, we also have more news about Shirley Sherrod. She's the former USDA official who was forced to resign last month after her comments about overcoming racial prejudice were used out of context during the firestorm in which she lost her job. She was initially blasted by some in the media, her superiors at the Obama administration, and the NAACP. Well, this week, Sherrod officially made peace with the civil rights organization. In an open letter, she wrote, quote, that's behind us, and the last thing I want to see happen is for my situation to weaken support for the NAACP. Interesting.
Very interesting development.
Thank you, Lee.
Thanks, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To weigh in with your own thoughts, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Again, that's 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. And you can also go to our website to read what other listeners are saying and to add your own comments. Log on to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.